From the front, the big blue sash that I'd worked so hard not to pee on saved the day. But there was nothing saving the sassy over-the-shoulder shots.
My wardrobe mishap was at the 62nd Emmy Awards. For the first time ever, a designer had offered to loan me a dress for an event. It was a beautiful strapless couture gown by Ramona Cavezza. It had a long train. I felt very fancy. I had never had to maneuver my way down a red carpet with a train before. It was more complicated than I thought. As I went down the red carpet, I would pick up my train and carry it to the next section of photographers and then let it down to pose. I quickly realized I had a whole evening of train maintenance ahead of me. I didn't care. I loved my dress. I watched as Jenna breezed her way down the carpet in her no-train dress and waited for me at the end so we could enter the event together. I had only one bank of photographers left, so I felt confident. I took a step, but couldn't seem to move. I was stuck on something. I took an even bigger, bolder step to try to free myself when suddenly my dress was violently yanked down. I had been standing on my own dress with one foot and yanking off my dress with the other. My boobs nearly popped out. I immediately doubled over and grabbed my chest. Flash, flash, flash! It was all captured on film. Nearly every photo from this red carpet is of me fighting with my dress. I'm not saying you shouldn't wear a dress with a train on the red carpet, but definitely practice walking at home before you go.
Number 4. Take a lap. Take full advantage of the commercial breaks. During those minutes, everyone gets up and mingles. The room is basically a sea of your favorite stars chatting, laughing, and being fabulous and famous with one another. Get out there and enjoy.
Jenna loved walking around during commercial breaks. She called it taking a lap. I don't like mingling during the commercial breaks, but she always insisted. It's enough for me to have to walk a gazillion miles in my fancy dress and awful shoes to find a bathroom. After those adventures, I just want to kick off my high heels, eat one of the 3 peanuts that have been graciously placed on the table, and drink one of the 5 bottles of wine. But if you are with Jenna, she will say, "Come on! This is the freaking SAG Awards! Let's take a lap!" She's very persuasive. And so off we would go.
My mom told me I had to take advantage of these situations. You don't know how long you'll be invited to these parties, Jenna. Make the most of them. So yes, I wanted us to mingle. Everyone table hops, and commercial breaks are a great opportunity to meet people. Plus, there are often television stars and movie stars in attendance at these events. So I would make Angela put her shoes on and walk around the room with me. I also had a strategy on how to walk up to celebrities you didn't know. First of all, you have to be smiling as you approach them. And then, right as you get close, begin to laugh. Continue to stand there and laugh, and then say hello. I'm telling you, this works. That is how we met Meryl Streep.
This is one of Jenna's proudest accomplishments of all the award shows we attended. Early in the evening, she spotted Meryl Streep, and she was laser-focused on meeting her. We began doing our laps around the room, but with no luck. I thought Jenna might have given up and I'd get to eat some peanuts, but then Jenna saw Amy Adams talking to Meryl. My BFF leapt out of her seat and began to drag me across the room. She said, "Angela, come on, come on. This is our chance. We know Amy. We'll walk up to Amy and she'll introduce us." As we got closer to them, you could tell they were mid-conversation. And then the lights started dimming, signaling us to return to our seats because the show was about to resume. I started to backpedal, but Jenna was determined. That's when, on the fly, Jenna came up with her walk-up laughing plan. I didn't have time to think it through. We were about to be right next to them. Jenna stepped forward, boldly laughing. I trailed behind her, half-ass laughing. And I'll be damned if Amy didn't turn and smile and introduce Jenna to Meryl Streep. Then the lights dimmed again and everyone dispersed. I never met Meryl.
You came very close to meeting Meryl. Can we just take a moment to acknowledge that my plan worked? The lap around the room laughing approach is a winner. Meryl looked at me right in the eyes and smiled. She said my name, and I'm pretty sure she glanced over my shoulder at Angela. We sort of met Meryl Streep, and no one can take it away from us. I'd just like to say I feel like this chapter is making it very clear that I am the best person in the world to attend an award show with. You will get food and meet Meryl Streep. As a huge bonus, a photographer captured the moment, and now we can treasure it forever.
Number 5. Play it cool. Be prepared to be approached by famous people. It's true. Sometimes the tables turn, and sometimes super famous people want to meet you or get a photo with you instead of you fake laughing your way into a Hollywood royalty photo op. If you're like us, this will blow your mind.
I will never forget the time I was crossing the room at an Emmys party and ran right into Sally Field. Like, literally ran into her. I was mortified. I said, "Oh my goodness, I'm so sorry." She said, "Jenna Fisher?" And I said, "Sally Field? You know my name?" And she said, "Oh yes, I am a huge fan." I played it cool and said something like, "Oh my goodness, that means so much to me. I just love your films." She gave me a hug and told me she couldn't wait to see more of my work in the future. She walked away, and then I pooped myself. Not literally, but metaphorically. Guys, Sally Field was one of my idols growing up. There were three actresses that I studied: Deborah Winger, Shelley Long, and Sally Field. And she just told me she knew me and was a fan. When I got home that night, I called my mom and woke her up. It was after midnight in Missouri, and screamed, "Sally Field knows me!" I knew my mom would get it, and she did. She started screaming with me and said, "Oh, Jenna, that is just so cool. I remember taking you to watch her movies over and over again." I'd just like to point out, these are exactly the types of experiences my mom didn't want me to miss out on by refusing to mingle.
Of all the famous folks I've met, the one encounter that took me completely by surprise didn't actually happen at an award show or a fancy party, but rather in a Southwest Airlines terminal. Back in March of 2018, my tall friend, Rain Wilson, was set to host an event in San Francisco for the Tahereh Justice Center. They are an amazing nonprofit organization that helps immigrant survivors fleeing gender-based violence. Due to a scheduling conflict, Rain was unable to attend, and he asked if I could step in for him. After hearing the stories of the women Tahereh had helped over the years, my answer was an enthusiastic yes. It was an amazing night, and I am still in awe of what this organization does for others. The next morning, I had an early flight back to Los Angeles out of San Francisco International Airport. While my husband was looking for coffee, the airline announced that it was time to board the plane. I grabbed our carry-on luggage and went to stand in line, when a shy young gal in a hoodie sweatshirt and baggy orange pants walked up to me and asked if I'd take a photo with her. I said, "Of course," and a big smile came across her face. She introduced me to her brother, Phineas, and he snapped a few photos of us. She was such a sweetheart, and even in those few moments, I was charmed by her. She told me thank you, and we said goodbye. My husband walked up with coffee and a donut, bless him, and asked me who she was. I said I didn't know, just a lovely Office fan. We got on the plane, and I didn't think much more about it until a few days later, when I suddenly noticed I'd been tagged a gazillion times in a photo of me and the sweet gal from the airport. That gal was Billie Eilish. If I wasn't 100 years old, maybe I would have recognized her when she approached me. The photo she posted of us, as the kids say, went viral. I immediately downloaded her music and was blown away by her voice. "Billie, not only are you crazy talented, but you also share the same name as my sister and my dad, so you are already a winner in my book. And you made me seem cool to my kids, so thank you."
Number 6. Share this moment with someone you love.
One of my most cherished memories is when I took my dad to the Emmys in 2009. I wasn't sure what he would make of the whole award show scene. My dad had grown up on a ranch in rural Texas and in his early 20s began a career working on oil rigs. Suits were not part of his job description. Despite his rugged lifestyle, my dad was a devoted family man. My mom, my sisters, and I were his whole life. When I told him that I wanted to move away from home to become an actress, he cried. He couldn't imagine me so far away, and he struggled with my career choice. But true to his loyal heart, he became my biggest champion. My mom shared with me that he was so thrilled when I asked him to be my date to the Emmy Awards that he bought their plane tickets that very day. He and my mom made a deal that he would go to the actual awards with me, but that she would be my date for all the pre-show parties. He didn't want her to feel left out. Mom put together her outfit pretty quickly, but Dad agonized over the perfect suit to wear. They drove 25 miles to the nearest Joss A. Bank men's clothing store so he could go suit shopping. My dad never met a stranger, and Mom told me he told everyone he was going with his daughter to an award show in Los Angeles. On the day of the Emmys, he couldn't stop smiling. He chatted up the hair and makeup gals. He chatted up our limo driver. He chatted up the award show staff as we waited on the red carpet. Thanks to my dad, several people learned our whole life story before the ceremony ever took place. As I walked the red carpet, photographers were yelling out my name. My dad was beside himself. He couldn't believe that all those people knew my name. Then a photographer asked me who my date was, and I said my dad, and I gave his name, Bill Kinsey. As we turned a corner to the next bank of photographers, one of them called out, "Mr. Kinsey, Bill, over here!" My dad's eyes got big as saucers, and he enthusiastically waved back. He was so tickled. During the ceremony, we were seated next to Jenna and Lee, and in the first commercial break, they got up to mingle. That classic Jenna move. Well, they didn't make it back to their seats in time and were temporarily stuck outside the theater until the next commercial break. Two strangers promptly took their place. My dad was worried and leaned over to me and said, "We got a couple of hitchhikers." He was convinced these interlopers had stolen Jenna and Lee's seats. My dad politely whispered to the seat fillers that those seats were taken and they needed to find other ones. He then put my purse and program on Jenna and Lee's seats so no one else would take them. I had to tell my dad that they were actually doing their job. Seat fillers are hired by award shows to make sure whenever a camera sweeps the audience that all seats are filled. When the actor comes back, the seat fillers return to the wings. Well, that was more than my dad could wrap his mind around. He had endless questions for me about seat fillers for the rest of the night.
I remember this very clearly because the first time I went to an award show, I thought people were stealing our seats too. Being at these big events can be overwhelming, especially for someone who is more of an introvert like I am. I know we've shared a lot about my bold drive to make the most of these evenings, but I was only able to do that because I had Angela by my side. She gives me courage. She also keeps me safe, both emotionally and physically. There is no better example of this than the time she quite literally had to scoop me off the floor at a press event for The Office in New York City. It was May 2007, and we were in New York promoting the season 3 finale of the show. During the day, we did interviews and participated in a live presentation to advertisers. In the evening, there was a meet and greet party, where actors from different shows mingled with press and advertisers as a way to build up publicity and ad revenue. As Angela would say, it's work, but it's fancy work. On this particular evening, the party was at a club called Budokan. The venue has two floors separated by a long marble staircase. We entered on the top floor, where there was a small bar with drinks. The staff was serving a pineapple daiquiri-type cocktail. I'm not much of a drinker, but I love a fruity beverage in a novelty glass, so I grabbed one. To get to the main part of the event, you had to go down the long set of marble stairs. I had my fancy drink in my hand as I did my best to walk down the stairs. I took one sip of my daiquiri, and something terrible happened. My foot slipped out from underneath me, and I went crashing down on the edge of the stairs. Hard. To add insult to injury, I also threw my drink in my own face. I was sitting on the ground, covered in daiquiri, and feeling like I might vomit when the room started to spin. A bouncer came over and immediately started treating me like a boozy Hollywood starlet. I tried to explain that I hadn't even had a full sip of my drink, that in fact it was all over my head. but I was disoriented. I was probably slurring my words. He picked me up and whisked me away to a back room. Angela followed. I told her my back hurt and I didn't feel good. She lifted up the back of my shirt and immediately said, "Call an ambulance."
I was behind Jenna on that staircase, and I saw her go down. Someone had spilled something on those stairs, and they were slick. Jenna was wearing wedge high heels, and she turned her ankle. When she fell, I couldn't stop it. I saw it all happen in slow motion right in front of me. Her back was purple and swollen. There was a small cut and some blood. It did not look good, and I was scared.
I only remember bits and pieces after that. I remember being loaded into an ambulance. I remember getting morphine and an X-ray. I definitely remember that Angela was by my side the entire time. Even when the nurses came in to give me a catheter, she stayed. I remember being asked, "Would you like your friend to step out while we give you this catheter?" And answering, "Not only would I prefer she stayed, I'd like to hold her hand."
There was no way I was leaving her for a second. I climbed into the back of the ambulance and told them, "She has no family here, and she's going to an emergency room in a city that's not her own. I'm not going anywhere. You are stuck with me." They didn't mess with me after that.
I vaguely remember something about a man being handcuffed to the bed next to me.
Oh, yes. The police walked him in, and he was very surly. They handcuffed him to the chair next to your hospital bed and left. I shut the little curtain around us, but if I hadn't been there to do that, Jenna would have been staring at a surly drunk guy for hours.
Eventually, I was admitted and moved to a room. Angela took up residence in the chair next to my bed, and we drifted in and out. Or at least I did. But I'll never forget the doctor coming in to give me my X-ray result. He said, "The good news is you're going to walk again." I said, "Well, that is good news. However, it feels like there is a lot of bad news if you're leading with that." As it turns out, I had fractured 4 of the transverse vertebrae in my back. If you're going to have a back injury, I guess this is the best one because it will heal on its own, similar to a broken rib. And motion is the best thing for it. So even though walking and moving were painful, I was encouraged to do it. I was told I would be discharged in the morning, but that I was not allowed to travel for at least 2 weeks.
Here's a crazy twist to the story. NBC had put the entire cast up at the Ritz-Carlton for the 2 days that we were doing press. We had been so excited. Talk about country mouse come to town. We were at the fancy schmancy Ritz-Carlton facing Central Park. Well, when Jenna broke her back, NBC had to extend her stay for 2 weeks.
That's right. I lived at the Ritz-Carlton for 2 weeks with my broken back. Angela stayed with me for the first week. My family headed out to New York to help me, but they needed a few days to get there. My office castmates all came by to visit as I recovered. When Creed stopped in, the 3 of us watched the Larry Sanders Show together. Laughter really is the best medicine. After my accident, I couldn't shower for several days. That fruity pineapple drink I'd thrown all over the left side of my head got very smelly. I mean, I was gross. I'm sorry you had to live with that, Ange.
I think every friendship has milestone moments that forever bond you. Trying to wash rotten pineapple daiquiri out of your friend's hair before gently lowering her onto the toilet is definitely one of those moments.
Yeah, that's best friendship right there. That brings us to number 7. Have fun. Definitely dance the night away with your friends and castmates. The office cast always took over the dance floor at every event. Don't be afraid to dork out. And if dancing isn't your thing, have fun in other ways. Stage a fight or jump into the pool in your evening dress. We've done it all.
Whether it was at the Emmys or SAG Awards or NBC publicity parties, we were the center of the action in those days. During the after party for the 2009 SAG Awards, Creed jumped on stage and sang with the band. No one cuts a rug like Craig Robinson, and any time they played Beyoncé's Single Ladies, Jenna, Oscar, and I took to the dance floor to recreate the music video.
One year, we decided to stage a fight in the middle of the after party for the SAG Awards. We'd been joking about how no one believed that our cast were actually all friends in real life and that our show was drama-free. Rumors of infighting on the sets of Desperate Housewives and Grey's Anatomy were big tabloid fodder at the time, and it felt like reporters were looking to find more of these stories anywhere they could. Several of us had journalists corner us on the red carpet and say, "Come on, you guys really all get along? There must be something you aren't telling us." By the way, I always found these questions so funny. First of all, there really was no drama. But if there was, would we have shared about it on the red carpet? Could you imagine their faces if I'd said, "Oh, I've been wanting to talk about our on-set drama for years. Thanks for asking." Anyway, we were joking that we should stage a huge fight just to see what would happen. So we did. It started with me and BJ fake fighting, having a huge argument. And then Kate got in the mix. Finally, it ended with a fake brawl, Angela pulling my hair. But nothing happened. No one believed it. In fact, during our time on the show, we were rarely the subject of tabloid gossip. When we were, it was comical. I remember reading a story in the National Enquirer trying to imply that John Krasinski and I were secretly dating. Their proof was a report from an inside source that we ate lunch together alone in my trailer every day. When I showed the article to John and Angela on set, we all laughed so hard. John said, "They meant Angela. You eat lunch with Angela every day." As funny as it was, I'll admit it was weird to read a 100% false story about myself in a tabloid. Growing up, I always knew that not everything you read was true, but I figured there must be some element of the story that was true or they couldn't print it. But no, in fact, that wasn't the only time it happened to me. A few years later, Star printed a story about how I was dating David Spade. There were all kinds of details from a pal of mine about how we'd met at a party, he'd made me laugh, and we started dating. The pal even made sure to add that the relationship was just light and fun. Guys, not only was I not dating David Spade, I'd never met David Spade. It was so bonkers. Years later, I ran into him and we talked about the fake story. He told me he got in a lot of trouble from that article with the girl he was actually dating at the time. Ironically, while all these totally fake stories were being written, Angela jumped into a pool in her cocktail dress during an after party and no one wrote a word.
Not jumped, dove. I proudly dove into that swimming pool in my cocktail dress. Brian and I had been to several parties that night, and our last party was poolside at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. It was a beautiful night, and steam was coming off the heated pool. I watched this dapper guy in a fantastic suit casually stroll down the steps into the pool, and then his date followed shortly after. Imagine two beautifully dressed people lounging on the steps of a swimming pool. It looked glorious. So, I took off my red high heels and handed them to Brian. He asked me where I was going, and I said, "To the deep end." I walked the length of the pool and stood at the deep end as a crowd gathered around me. I leapt in the air and dove headfirst into the pool. When I came up for air, the entire party applauded. I highly recommend swimming in a cocktail dress. The fabric billows around you in the water, and you feel like an underwater fairy princess. However, bring a change of clothes because the damp car ride home is not so magical.
If we can leave you with anything, it's this. If you have the chance to be at fun events with your friends, celebrate, dance, enjoy. Do not waste time being too cool for school. Own the moment. Own every moment. Like my mom said, these moments won't last forever. And when they are gone and you aren't with your friends, you won't regret the time you spent dancing your face off or swimming in a cocktail dress or walking up to Meryl Streep laughing. Trust me. Chapter 9, Jam, by Jenna. Jim plus Pam equals Jam. Imagine walking into a room, a song starts playing, and suddenly you and a complete stranger begin to dance in perfect unison. That's what it felt like when I first read my scenes with John Krasinski at our audition for The Office. From the moment we met, it was like we shared the jam brain. We instantly clicked. John and I have both shared that when our agents initially gave us the news that we'd been cast on the show, our first questions were, did Jenna Fischer get the role of Pam? And did John Krasinski get the role of Jim? We knew our best shot at doing this job right was doing it together. John Krasinski is like family. I feel so fortunate to have worked with him for nearly 10 years bringing the story of Jim and Pam to life. In real life, John and I are both happily married to other people. John to Emily Blunt, me to Lee Kirk. In fact, we got married within 1 week of each other in July 2010, and now we both have two kids. I always say, he found his Pam, and I found my Jim. John, Emily, Lee, and I are all good friends. I adore Emily. Actually, I more than adore her. I admire her. She's a force. She's also engaging and funny and giving. When my family briefly relocated to London while I filmed the British television series You, Me, and the Apocalypse, Emily put together a list of fun things to do in London with my kids. And after we arrived, John and Emily took us to dinner, and later we all met up for playdates. It made the relocation so much easier on our family because we were there with such close friends. Before we had families, we did all kinds of things together, from late-night dinner parties to traveling together. If you ever get the chance to spend time with John and Emily, be prepared to laugh. A lot. These days, John and Emily split their time between New York and London, so we see them less frequently. But when John made his stage debut at the Public Theater in 2016 in the play Dry Powder, Lee and I flew in to see it. John and Emily had come to support me when I had my off-Broadway stage debut, so I knew what a big deal this was. We had to be there. John was great, of course. Nowadays, whenever any of us pass through the other city, we make it a point to reach out and see one another. John and Emily are enthusiastic cheerleaders, amazing hosts, and just all-around lovely people. I could go on and on about how much our friendship has meant to me over the years, but let's get to why we are here. Let's talk jam. Jim and Pam's connection is obvious from the start of the series. Although Pam is engaged to Roy, she spends most of her day talking and flirting with Jim. It is only a matter of time until these two get together, and the writers did such a wonderful job of crafting the slow evolution of their relationship. Greg made sure there was always one Jim and Pam moment per episode. It was either a moment of connection, something as simple as a glance across the conference room or a prank they play on Dwight, or a moment of disconnect. Like when Jim doesn't give Pam a gift for Valentine's Day. Scenes with Jim and Pam got a lot of attention on set. We would shoot and reshoot these moments, making tiny adjustments until we got them just right. Often, the rest of the cast had to wait hours for us to finish. Sorry, guys. John and I were equally invested in the Jim and Pam story. Our connection to the characters was natural, so we could easily feel our way through a scene on instinct alone. But we also had a lot of discussions about these moments, breaking them down intellectually, too, as part of the story. A good example of this was our very long discussion during the email surveillance episode, Season 2. Does Pam sit on Jim's bed when he gives her the tour of his bedroom? And if so, when? Sometimes we'd discuss a moment back and forth over and over until one of us would finally say, "Wait, I got it. The cameras would start rolling and the other would instinctively know what to do. Creating those scenes was so exhilarating. And when we'd created something special, we knew it. When I think back on our journey, there are certain moments that stick out for me. One of my favorites is from Season 2, The Client. In that episode, Michael goes to Chili's with Jan to woo a big potential client. Back in the office, Pam finds a movie script Michael has been writing, the infamous Threat Level Midnight. The employees all gather in the conference room for a hilarious table read. Afterward, Jim makes Pam grilled cheese sandwiches and they eat together up on the roof. To me, it's their first dinner date. Shooting that scene on the roof is one of my fondest memories of the show. We shot on the actual roof of our soundstage, and the only people permitted on the roof were Greg Daniels, Paul Lieberstein, our first assistant director, a boom operator, the director of photography, Randall Einhorn, John, and me. It was a warm summer evening. The only set was two folding chairs, a candle, and delicious grilled cheese sandwiches. We took our seats and the scene began. Off in the distance, Rain and Brian, aka Dwight and Kevin, set off fireworks. Unfortunately, the fireworks were so tiny we could barely see them from the rooftop. Greg told Rain and Brian to jump, yell, dance around, anything to make the scene more visually interesting. The guys did their best, screaming and waving their arms, which makes the scene very funny. But this episode was significant in other ways. When The Office was picked up for a second season, the network only ordered 6 episodes. The client was episode number 7, the first in our extended order. A big part of my bond with John arose from the fact that The Office was each of our first series. I remember turning to John and saying, "We are really on this TV show." And he smiled. He got it. I didn't want the scene to end. Jim and Pam's flirtation ultimately culminates with a kiss during the season 2 finale, Casino Night. We can't have a chapter about Jim and Pam and not talk about that kiss on Casino Night. I've been told it's one of the most romantic moments in TV history, and I'd have to agree. But there is a different scene from Casino Night that John and I were most focused on. It is before the kiss, in the parking lot, when Jim tells Pam he is in love with her. Everyone agreed that the parking lot scene would set everything in motion. If we didn't nail it, the kiss wouldn't matter. Because our director, Ken Kwapis, felt it would be the most challenging from an emotional standpoint, he moved the parking lot scene to the end of the week's schedule. Yes, we shot the kissing scene before the confession in the parking lot. How crazy is that? When it was time, it was the very end of the day. The entire cast had been sent home. We gathered in the parking lot, where we must have talked about the scene for an hour before we began. Greg and Ken discussed where the cameras should be, if Jim and Pam should know they are being filmed, or if the cameras should be hidden in a spy shot. We all spent time discussing the dialogue, eventually deciding that Pam should be in the middle of teasing Jim when he shocks her with his confession. So Pam's lines, "Oh, do you want me to take your money now, or I could take it later, or when do you," were all playful banter that we came up with on the spot. Ken told John to cut me off at a different point in each take so that I could never be quite sure when Jim would say, "I'm in love with you." It was a brilliant idea that worked perfectly. I was completely surprised every time. Later in the scene, when Pam says, "I'm really sorry you misinterpreted our friendship," John improvised the line, "Don't," and started to cry. This took me off guard, and I could feel the blood flush my face. It was so hard to stand there while John cried as Jim. I felt horrible rejecting him this way, even fictionally. John's performance was brilliant. He broke all our hearts in that moment. After the scene was over, I wanted to rush over and say, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." As for the kissing scene, John confessed that it was his first on-screen kiss. I had done a couple of kissing moments with David Denman, who played Roy, but those weren't the kind of swoony romantic kisses that this scene required. Up to this point, my only romantic kissing scene had been in a movie called Born Champion, one of my first acting jobs. But of course, that kiss in no way compared to this one. It seemed like everyone in the cast, crew, and viewing public had been waiting to see Jim and Pam kiss, and we had to get it right. We asked questions. How big should the kiss be? How long does it go on? How much does Pam kiss Jim back? but we never rehearsed the scene. Everyone agreed we should let even our first attempts at this moment play out while the cameras were rolling. On the day of the shoot, John and I were both very nervous. We didn't want to mess up this pivotal moment and let everyone down. Understanding the stakes involved, Ken planned to keep things casual and act like it was just another day of shooting. His plans were foiled before the day even began when the entire cast and crew were handed the shooting schedule for the day, which had been printed with "Jim Kisses Pam," bold, all caps, italics, and 3 exclamation points across the top. To create the right mood, Ken brought me to set without John to walk through the scene alone. This approach was different from how we normally did things. It was strange being on set by myself, with the lighting moody and dark. There was a long discussion about where I should stand. "Wouldn't I just stand at reception?" I asked. I was told there were concerns about this placement because the reception desk would block too much of the action, as the plan was to hide the camera in the kitchen and shoot secretly through the blinds in a spy shot. Actually, they called it a super secret spy shot. Eventually, we settled on Jim's desk. We worked out how I could position myself with the phone, allowing for the camera to read some but not all of my reactions. Ken felt that having my reactions partially blocked would create suspense. After my location was chosen, I was told to go back to my trailer and wait. This was also a very strange request. We never sat in our trailers alone between scenes. As I'm sure you've gathered by now, we were a social bunch. But I did as Ken asked and went to my trailer to wait. Meanwhile, John was going through a different experience. He was never brought to set for a walkthrough rehearsal at all. Instead, he was left wandering around the backstage area alone, wondering where we'd gone. When Ken Kwapis came on Office Ladies, we asked him why he made the decision to keep us separated like this. He explained that since we hadn't yet filmed the parking lot scene, he wanted to manufacture some of the tension that our characters might be feeling when the kiss happened, and decided that separating us might just do that. Well, the plan worked. Oblivious to what was happening, John was suddenly called backstage and told that the scene was ready to roll, having no idea that I'd been placed at his desk. He was instructed to wait for Ken to call action, walk in the office, find me, and do the scene. He had no idea where I'd be in the room, which is probably why his reaction to seeing me at his desk is so genuine. After all this buildup, I hoped we'd get it right. I remember my heart was pounding as I waited for the scene to begin. I heard action, John appeared, and we filmed the scene. We only did 3 takes. I'll never forget the smile on Greg's face when we wrapped that day. He knew we'd nailed it. But as wonderful as it was, Jim and Pam's kiss does not result in them getting together. Pam says she still plans to marry Roy, and Jim transfers to Stanford. Ugh! And even though Pam eventually breaks her engagement with Roy, Jim and Pam spend most of season 3 estranged. It isn't until the Beach Games episode, written by Greg Daniels and Jen Salata, and directed by Harold Ramis, that Pam gets one step closer to a relationship with Jim. But first, she takes a stroll across some hot coals. When I spoke to Greg about this episode, he told me the early obstacle to Jim and Pam being together was Roy. Then it was distance, and then it was Karen. He wanted the final obstacle to be Pam's internal struggle, overcoming her timidity and willingness to accept less than she deserved in life. His vision was to have Pam reveal the same type of courage that Jim had shown in the season 2 finale, Casino Night. But Greg did not want this important moment to happen in the season 3 finale. Quote, "The trick was to bury it inside the Beach Games story so you didn't see it coming." When I first read the script for Beach Games, Pam's final speech made me cry. Everything comes pouring out of her. She confesses her sadness that people didn't come to her art show. She reveals her feelings for Jim and how much she misses him. But most of all, she shares the big truth, which is that while there were many reasons to call off her wedding to Roy, The true motivation was her feelings for Jim. It was absolutely perfect. People often ask me if that speech was improvised. Nope, not one word. Jen Salata told me that while she had co-written the episode, Greg wrote Pam's speech himself. I memorized it and delivered it word for word. I knew how important this moment was for Pam and believed that the better I knew the material, the more I could focus on my performance. I wrote out notes in my script, recalling moments in my life when I had experienced a rush of adrenaline like the one Pam would be feeling after she walked over the coals, and how that elation would drive me and her to be impulsive. I wanted her speech to feel pieced together in the moment, while also revealing she had spent many sleepless nights going over these feelings and these words in her head. I thought of the Academy Awards, when an actor who's been a long shot is suddenly the winner, finding herself on stage, speaking from the heart while also patching together a speech she's been practicing since she was a little girl. People also ask me if I really walked across hot coals. I wish I could say I did, but the coals were not heated. Our crew did an amazing job of making them look real. They dug a hole in the ground and wired a giant flickering light box with yellow and orange gels to make it appear as if the coals were burning. Then they covered the box with lava rocks, adding gas lines on either side of the path with tiny flickers of real fire. I was directed to make sure I stayed in the center of the path, since the flames on the sides were in fact very real. The coals weren't hot, but they did hurt. Imagine scattering a bunch of Legos on the ground and then walking over them. That's what it felt like. By the time I was set to deliver Pam's big speech, the temperature had dropped, I was quite cold, and my feet were throbbing. And like Pam, my adrenaline kicked in. I walked up to my castmates and steadied myself to speak. This was my first experience with being the center of attention in a scene. In 3 seasons, Pam had never been in the center of the action. Most of my acting career had been spent in supporting roles. And here I was, all eyeballs on me. This was my glimpse at what Steve did every single day, every single week. I was so nervous. I wanted to nail this moment for our gal Pam. I can't remember how many takes we did of the speech, but I do remember that Greg had come to set to watch the filming. Greg, Harold Ramis, and Jen Salata all hovered over little video monitors in a tent next to where we were shooting. After the first take, I looked over to the tent and they were all peeking out smiling. Jen gave me a big smile and a thumbs up. I was able to relax a little after that. This scene was the start of a major shift for Pam. It was the moment she took charge of her own life. And for me, it was a personal milestone as an actor. Just like Pam, I gained confidence that night, too. My most treasured moments playing Pam were the times like this, when our lives intersected perfectly and we both found our voice together. Another big production moment was Jim and Pam's engagement. Greg Daniels decided Jim should propose to Pam at the end of the Season 5 premiere episode, Weight Loss. Why did Greg embed such an important plot point in the premiere episode? Because he didn't want the viewers to see it coming. You might be noticing a trend. Greg liked to do that. Greg wanted the proposal to feel special, but he also wanted it to feel like Jim made the decision without a lot of planning. This inspired his idea for the location of this scene, a gas station along the freeway between Scranton and New York in the rain. We based the station on one that Greg Daniels had traveled to as a kid along the Merritt Parkway in New York. But instead of flying us there, our production designer Michael Gallenberg and his team built one in the parking lot of a Best Buy in Los Feliz, California. Yeah, you heard that right. They used Google Street View to capture images of the Merritt Parkway station, then built one to match. The interior of the gas station is a series of high-definition photographs. Those soda bottles and cereal boxes inside the window are not real, folks. To create the illusion of traffic, a 4-lane parkway was constructed and stunt drivers were brought in to drive all varieties of cars, trucks, and semis in a giant circle around the set and in front of the cameras. Our production manager, Randy Cordray, hired 35 precision drivers who went around us at 55 miles per hour. I could feel the wind from the vehicles as they zoomed past. On top of all of this, rain machines were brought in. It felt like I was on the set of a major film production, like maybe Vin Diesel was driving by in one of those cars about to start a chase sequence. After we shot the scene, the team sent the footage to a special effects company that replaced the California mountains in the background with tall East Coast trees and foliage. This was the single most expensive and elaborate scene we shot during the entire run of the show. They had only 9 days to scout, design, and build the set. The 52-second scene cost $250,000 to shoot. Now, it was time to get these two hitched. Jim and Pam's wedding created some of my favorite off-screen moments, especially when we filmed at Niagara Falls. This was the only time I ever traveled outside of California to shoot something for the office, and it almost didn't happen. The original plan had been to send a camera operator to shoot footage of the falls and then insert John and me via green screen from a soundstage. Our line producer, Randy Cordray, was not on board with this idea. He fought very hard to have John and me travel to Niagara and shoot the scene on one of the Maid of the Mist boats. This was not an easy task, as Niagara Falls straddles the United States and Canada. Getting permission to shoot on the boats was complicated, and the budget to make it happen was very tiny, but he was determined to make it work. About 3 weeks before the shoot, Randy went to Niagara, New York for a technical scout with director Paul Feig and cinematographer Randall Einhorn. They rode the Maid of the Mist a few times to plan how they might shoot the scenes on the boat. Randy secured permission to do the shoot, but there were a lot of rules. One being that we could not rent out the entire boat. We could only reserve the front. Second, the boat would not be allowed to go off course. Finally, the rest of the boat would still be filled with tourists. During their scout, Randy, Paul, and Randall timed the trip out to the falls and back. They needed to calculate how much dialogue we could realistically shoot in one trip, and so how many trips were needed in total. It was decided we would reserve 8 trips to the falls, 4 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. Another concern was the water. You get sprayed from the falls depending on the time of day and the wind. While they didn't get too wet, Randall was concerned he wouldn't be able to shoot against the white falls with the spray of the water using our usual high-definition digital cameras. So Randall requested a 16mm film camera fitted with a special motorized rotating filter that literally spun the water off the lens. The production budget only allowed for a small group of us to travel for 1 day of shooting on the Maid of the Mist. Our little group consisted of John and me, of course, joined by Mindy Kaling, who co-wrote the episode, our director Paul Feig, Randy, Randall, and a small skeleton crew. On our first night in town, we all went out for dinner together. It was the cast and crew around a large table laughing over some shared chicken wings. The folks in town were so excited to have us there that they gathered outside the restaurant to meet us. Since we normally shot in such an isolated area, it was fun to be out in the world, seeing the impact and enthusiasm for the show. The hotel where we were staying had a lot of fun with the fact that Jim and Pam were getting married. When I first arrived in my room, the hotel had left a wedding basket for me. It had a variety of chocolates, candies, flowers, champagne, and 2 champagne flutes with hearts on the stems. They were so cute, I kept them. The one bummer was that my bestie Angela wasn't with me on this trip to share all the fun. I had to eat all the chocolates myself. The morning of the shoot, I had to arrive almost 2 hours before John at 5 a.m. to get my hair done and do my fancy wedding makeup. When John finally arrived, he was very sick with the flu. He couldn't keep anything down, but we couldn't change the shoot schedule, and we had to fly back the next day. I felt so terrible for him. It was clear he was miserable. At 9 a.m., we boarded the boat and were handed blue made-of-the-mist parkas. The boat captain made an announcement telling everyone to expect a little spray by the falls. We loaded our group into the front of the boat as planned. Since we were only allowed so many in that space, Randy volunteered to play the minister who marries Jim and Pam. One ticket for double duty of actor and production manager. To fill in the background, we brought on family members of the cast and crew. Greg Daniels' assistant, Mary Wall, was from the area, and her family volunteered to ride with us. Brian Baumgartner's parents, Bruce and Cherry, happened to be on vacation in Rochester, New York, with plans to visit the falls the same day we were shooting. They stopped by the set, and Paul Feig talked them into coming along for the shoot. You can see them walking right behind Jim and Pam as we board the boat. Because the rest of the boat was filled with paying customers watching us film, we were all very concerned that this particular plot point would leak. No one was allowed to come to the front where we were filming, but they were free to take photos and videos. So before every journey, John and I gave a little speech, posed for photos, and asked people to help us keep the secret. Amazingly, the secret never got out. We tried to get as much footage of the wedding scenes as we could on the first trip out to the falls while we were nice and dry, just in case we got wet when we arrived. Well, it's a good thing we shot the wedding footage on that first pass because I got soaked when we floated by the falls. John got a little wet, but I got drenched. It was like people threw buckets of water on me for 10 minutes. My hair was sopping wet and I had eye makeup running down my face. You know that beautiful moment at the end of the wedding montage where the camera is on our backs as we look toward the falls, Pam's head on Jim's shoulder, and then Jim turns and smiles to camera? That shot happened because I couldn't turn around or have my face on camera. It was the only thing we could shoot on the way back to the docks. We went back on shore and regrouped. The hair, makeup, and wardrobe team attempted to dry us off and redo my hair and makeup as best they could. Then we went out in the boat again. Same thing, sheets of water. I remember thinking, we're supposed to pass by the falls, not under the falls, right? Besides the water, our other big concern that day was the wedding kiss. Everyone was afraid I'd catch John's flu. John was especially protective of me. But we also knew you can't film a wedding scene without a kiss. So we got creative with the angle of the shot. I put polysporin up my nose, John pursed his lips tightly, we held our breath, and I basically kissed his cheek. We hoped that by intercutting with a great kiss back at the church, no one would notice the cheat. We got back to the docks again. I was beyond soaked, and John was still reeling from the flu. After just two trips, they felt we'd gotten what we needed. Thank goodness. Lunch break was called for the crew, and I went back to the hotel to shower and get completely redone while John rested. We had only a few other scenes to shoot of us arriving to the hotel, and then we would be done for the day. That's when Randy popped his head into the hair and makeup room. How do you feel about getting back on the boat? What? He explained that Randall had found a little water in the camera, and while they were pretty sure we could use the footage, it was important to take one more trip just to be sure we had what we needed. I thought John was going to die, but as miserable as he was probably feeling, he didn't complain once. The afternoon trip went much more smoothly, thanks to some sweet talking from Randy and an awesome boat captain. Randy got to chatting with the actual captain, a super nice guy and fan of the show. The captain said, "Man, you guys got soaked this morning, didn't you?" Randy laughed, telling the captain that management had made it clear that there would be no special alterations of the run just for our shoot. The captain was shocked. "What? They don't drive this boat, I do." So Randy gently suggested that maybe he could pause the boat a wee bit farther from the falls and keep us out of the wettest part of the spray? The captain was all too happy to help us out. Heck yeah, I'll do anything you guys want. Thank you, real boat captain. This time, as we approached the falls, we were hit by a light mist and a rainbow lit up the sky. Jackpot. Later, in season 6, Pam has their baby. It's a 2-part episode called Delivery. In part 1, Pam goes into labor at work but refuses to leave because her insurance only allows a certain amount of hospital time. Eventually, Jim gets her into the car with Michael. They head to the hospital, and Jim and Pam's daughter, Cecilia CC Marie Halpert, is born. Want to hear something adorable? We named Jim and Pam's baby after my niece, who had been born the week prior to shooting this episode. I had asked the writers, and they agreed. I didn't tell my sister. I waited patiently for the episode to air so it would be a surprise. My sister called me freaking out that night. She was so touched by the gesture. The baby photo of Cece that went on my desk was a photo of my niece. My niece loves knowing this little tidbit, and fans get so tickled when I walk around with the real Cece and call her name. In part 2 of Delivery, we are in the hospital room with Jim and Pam as they navigate their immediate postpartum life. At the time, neither John or I had kids, so we peppered the parents and our cast and crew with questions about how to make these scenes most authentic. I think we did a pretty good job, but I never looked as good as Pam does in these scenes. My hair was a hot mess for days after giving birth to both of my kids. One of the scenes in the hospital room involves Jim and Pam struggling to swaddle baby Cece. The scene, as written, went like this. The baby is crying. Jim and Pam fumble around at swaddling, not really knowing what to do. Jim thinks he's done it, only to pick up the baby and have the swaddle fall off. The baby cries. John and I were thinking it would be pretty easy to not swaddle a baby since we'd never really done it before. But here's the thing. John Krasinski was instantly an amazing baby swaddler. He couldn't not swaddle the baby. I mean, as much as he tried to botch the job, every time he picked up the baby, it was perfectly swaddled and happily cooing in his arms. This went on for multiple takes. The producers said, "John, stop swaddling the baby." To start the scene, they would put a perfectly swaddled baby into the bassinet. On action, they undid the swaddle, and the baby would naturally get upset and cry. This killed us. Even though the baby nurse assured us the baby was okay, we didn't like hearing the baby cry. I think John's natural fatherly instincts kicked in, and he needed to swaddle that baby on some deep primal level that could not be quelled. He was engaged to Emily at the time. I remember watching the whole thing and thinking, this guy is going to make a kick-ass father. Emily chose well. Another fun thing about this episode was that my now husband, Lee Kirk, got to play Pam's lactation consultant, Clark. Before we started shooting the episode, Paul Lieberstein, who is now our showrunner, pulled me aside and told me that the writers had a funny idea for a storyline but wanted to run it by me first to make sure I was comfortable. He said that Pam would struggle with breastfeeding and the hospital would send a male lactation consultant. He said they thought it would be funny if this male nurse had to be massaging Pam's breasts in front of Jim, who would be struggling to act like it was no big deal. I guess this was based loosely on one of the writer's real-life experiences. He told me that to make me more comfortable, maybe my real-life fiancé Lee could play the role. That way, a stranger wouldn't be fondling me during this shoot. I told Lee, and he said he was game to give it a try. Lee came in for an audition and was given the part. At this point, John and Lee were already friends, so we had a blast. It was a blessing and a curse to have Lee there because we couldn't stop laughing. Jim and Pam go on to navigate a lot of things in their lives. New jobs, more children, a long-distance marriage. But they always seem to find their way. I love their journey from coworkers and friends to husband and wife to parents. I'm grateful that Greg Daniels had the courage to let their whole relationship play out on the show. So often we only see the courtship phase of relationships portrayed in Hollywood, not the marriage with all its ups and downs. I remember talking with Greg after Jim and Pam got married. A lot of people were worried that fans would lose interest in Jim and Pam once they got together. But Greg had confidence in us. He said that for the first part of the series, Jim and Pam are kept apart through a series of obstacles that they eventually overcome. And now that they were married, we could watch them tackle new obstacles together. Throughout the series, John and I fought very hard to never have any infidelity in the Jim and Pam relationship. When Pam went to art school, there was talk that maybe she would fall for her art school friend Alex, played by Rich Summer. Later, when Pam was on maternity leave, there was a storyline where her temp replacement Kathy hit on Jim. And in the last season, the boom operator Brian takes a shine to Pam. But in all these cases, Jim and Pam were faithful to each other. We felt that Jim and Pam could come back from many things, such as Jim investing their savings in a company without telling Pam, but infidelity had to be off the table. A series of breakups and makeups would leave the audience exhausted and unsatisfied. Before I close out this chapter, I should probably address the question people ask me most about Jim and Pam. What was written in the dang teapot letter? In our first Christmas episode from season 2, Jim gets Pam's name in the Secret Santa gift exchange, and he is giddy with excitement. But per the rules, he can only spend $20 on the gift. Knowing Pam loves tea, he gets her a teal teapot. He fills it with inside jokes from their friendship. A tiny pencil, a cassette tape, a boggle timer, hot sauce packets, and a school yearbook photo of Jim, which was John Krasinski's actual yearbook photo. But most important of all, Jim includes a note. Because, he explains, Christmas is the time to tell people how you feel. When Michael turns the Secret Santa gift exchange into a Yankee swap, Pam loses the teapot to Dwight, who plans to use it to clear his nasal passages. Jim manages to get it back from Dwight and present it to Pam, but he steals the note before she can see it, tucking it in his pocket. We will have to wait until season 9 of The Office for Pam to finally get the note. What exactly is written on the note has been torturing fans of The Office for decades. Because when Pam finally receives the note, we never reveal what was written on the card. Only John knows what was written on the first card, which was eventually lost. The replacement, which John wrote himself and was given to me while we were filming the final season, was an idea hatched by Greg Daniels. He suggested to John that he write me a personal note about what it meant to work together, bringing Jim and Pam to the screen for 9 years. Greg knew I'd cry. And I did. I opened the letter and read John's message and burst into tears. I don't think they could even use the first take. I'll never reveal what exactly was in his note, but as Pam said herself, just know, it was perfect. I loved playing Pam on The Office, and I especially loved getting to be a part of a love story that resonated with so many people. But more than anything, I loved Pam's journey from quiet receptionist, unsure of how to direct her own life, to finding her voice and living her truth. I love meeting young women who tell me that Pam's story has inspired them. It inspires me, too. Pam's dreams are not extraordinary. She wants to marry the man she loves, have a family, and feel creatively expressed in her work. In the end, she gets all three. It's not lost on me that the series ends when Pam's dreams come true. The documentary doesn't stop when Michael leaves. They keep filming. I like to think that's because they might have been following Pam all along.
Chapter 10. Big Pregs, Little Pregs, Fake Pregs.
Oh my goodness! Kate Flannery just walked in and she has a piano!
I think she's going to play a song for us.
Big Pregs, Little Pregs, Fake Pregs,
Wow!
That was so great.
Oh, and now Kate's leaving. Bye, Kate.
Oh, bye! She just has a piano on her hip.
Does she walk around like that?
Maybe so. How talented is she? What a great way to start this chapter, because we couldn't write a book about our best friendship without sharing about how we navigated our transitions into parenthood. As anyone with children can tell you, becoming a parent is life-altering. Schedules change, priorities change, and as a result, sometimes even friendships change.
We definitely had some bumpy moments once we became moms. We're going to give it to you straight, with all the details, because that's how we do it. Also, as you listen to the next chapter, be prepared to hear a lot about wedgies and bodily fluids. You've been warned.
While shooting season 4 of The Office, I was pregnant in real life, but my character of Angela was not. So we had to hide my belly behind all kinds of crazy things.
In season 6 of The Office, Pam was pregnant, but I was not pregnant in real life. I wore a prosthetic belly for the show that we affectionately called Fake Pregs.
In season 8, Angela Martin was pregnant, and I was the one who was Fake Pregs.
In season 8, Pam gets pregnant again, but this time I was also pregnant in real life.
This back and forth of one of us being real pregnant and one of us being fake pregnant became a source of confusion for everyone. One day on set, our script supervisor, Veda, looked up from her notes and said, "Wait, who is fake pregnant and who is real pregnant?"
The journey of our real and fake pregnancies and the way our friendship evolved during those times is the subject of this chapter. Big Pregs, Little Pregs, Fake Pregs.
I got pregnant first. It was the summer of 2007. I was so excited when I found out, and I couldn't wait to tell Jenna. It took everything I had not to call her the second I knew, but I wanted to deliver the news in person, so I decided to tell her at our lunch. Since we usually ate lunch together in Jenna's trailer, I knew that was my best shot at getting her alone. As soon as I walked in, Jenna launched into a long story about her cat, Andy. This was a common lunchtime subject. Her cat was always doing the craziest things. "Oh my God, lady, listen to this. When I went into my kitchen this morning, all the bottom cabinets were open. Like all of them, lady." This story went on for 5 minutes, you guys. Jenna loved that cat. Long story short, Andy had learned how to open the cabinets. I listened, laughed at her story, and waited. When she was finished, I blurted out, "I'm pregnant." I vaguely remember a thud and shrieking, and then after an epic bear hug, Jenna yelled, "Why did you let me go on and on about my cat?"
This is accurate, but let me explain the thud. I had been sent to lunch early because we were shooting something that didn't involve front reception. By the time Angela got to my trailer, I was finished eating and had gotten up to do some exercise. I kept 5-pound weights in my trailer and would do bicep curls or push-ups from time to time and call that a workout. I was trying, okay? So I was pumping iron and droning on about my cat as Angela listened patiently. Mid-curl, she told me she was pregnant. I dropped the weights to the ground, causing the loud thud, then screamed for joy and hugged my best friend. Our production assistant knocked on the door to ask if everything was okay. "Yes!" we yelled through our tears of joy. I knew how very much Angela wanted a child. I knew she would make a wonderful mother. I was just so happy for her.
In the weeks ahead, I shared the news with the rest of the cast, crew, and writing staff. Everyone was so excited. The writers started discussing how they might work the pregnancy into the show and what that might mean for Angela Martin. Then, something crazy happened. The entire television and movie-making industry shut down due to the writers' strike, and our show went on hiatus. No one knew how long the writers' strike would last. We had already filmed the first part of season 4, and I wasn't showing then. When we finally started production again, 4 months later, I was 7 months pregnant. I had a very obvious, very huge belly.
The characters and storylines of the show were meant to pick up right where we'd left off. There was no way Angela's character could be pregnant out of the blue. We knew we'd have to hide it, and for that, we had to get creative. Angela did a lot of scenes standing behind the copier or the ficus plant in the bullpen. My personal favorite belly hide was during dinner party. Andy Bernard and Angela Martin arrive at Jan and Michael's party together. The writers were puzzled as to how to disguise her pregnancy as they entered the condo. There was no copier in Michael's apartment. They came up with the idea of having Angela enter with a bouquet of flowers as a host gift. Pam brings wine, Angela brings flowers. Problem solved, right? Oh no. On the day of shooting, the prop team had to keep adding flowers to the bouquet until it was enormous. I mean, a truly ridiculous bouquet. But that's how we hid the belly. Angela was the first regular cast member to be pregnant on set, so it was as if we were all having that baby with her. Everyone was so protective, making sure she got enough to eat, drank enough water, sat down often enough. The crew even threw her a surprise baby shower in the set parking lot. At that same time, I teamed up with Angela's sister-in-law, Suzanne Daniels, and we threw a friends and family shower. Angela's mom, sisters, and grandmother all flew to Los Angeles for the event. Celebrating Angela's pregnancy with this multi-generational group of women was moving to me. These women, who had raised children of their own, were bringing Angela into the fold. It was a beautiful thing. At the same time, seeing Angela at her baby shower really drove home the fact that I was very far away from joining that flock.
During the same month of the dual showers, Jenna was turning 34. I wanted to be there for Jenna as her birthday approached. She was doing so much for me. But to illustrate the different directions our lives were taking, Jenna wanted to celebrate her birthday at a bar in West Hollywood called St. Nick's. It's no longer in business, but during its heyday, it was a great dive bar. Dark interior, old pleather booths, a jukebox, the best greasy burgers, and a back room with a dartboard. Imagine being 8 months pregnant and walking into that bar holding a sheet cake. Yes, I brought Jenna a sheet cake from the grocery store, and then I waddled to the back of the bar and ate half of it.
Angela, I will never forget looking over at you as you happily ate sheet cake and sang at the top of your lungs to Lynyrd Skynyrd playing on the jukebox. You were super pregnant, in a dive bar, getting all kinds of side eye from the other patrons. You did that for me, and I am forever grateful.
The day I had my little girl, Jenna drove my mom to the hospital. It was about half an hour through curved roads over the canyons of Los Angeles. My mom told me she held onto the passenger door handle with white knuckles as Jenna took those turns. She described Jenna as a speedy driver.